and welcome to another edition of the Security Ledger Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Roberts, the editor-in-chief and publisher at the Security Ledger. This week on the Security Ledger Podcast, we're going to delve deeper into the question of maritime cybersecurity, speaking with noted researcher Ruben Santamarta of the firm IOActive about the work he's done exposing vulnerabilities in the software that runs both commercial and Navy vessels. We're also sitting down to talk about proposed legislation on Capitol Hill to impose security standards on the fast-growing Internet of Things. Alan Brill, the Senior Managing Director in the Cybersecurity and Investigations Unit at the firm Kroll, came into the Security Ledger Studios to talk about the Internet of Things Cybersecurity Improvement Act, which was introduced earlier this month. And finally, we hear over and over again about the shortage of skilled information security professionals in the workplace and the need to attract more men and women to the field. But what about the computer scientists and engineers who emerge each year from undergraduate and graduate programs without the necessary skills that they need to contribute to security-conscious development organizations? We talked to Maria Lachlan, the Vice President of Engineering at Veracode, about why that is and how to fix it. But first, to the waters off the island nation of Singapore, where in the early morning hours of August 21st, the USS John McCain, a guided missile destroyer, collided with an oil tanker, the Alnwick, in the Strait of Malacca, a busy and narrow shipping lane. The accident caused severe damage and flooding on the McCain and cost the lives of 10 crew members, injuring 5 others. It was the second fatal accident in the last 3 months, following a fatal collision between the USS Fitzgerald and the ACX Crystal in June. There have been 2 other accidents involving ships from the U.S. Navy's 7th Fleet just since January. The spate of collisions between commercial vessels and Navy warships in recent months is unprecedented in recent Navy history. In fact, before this year, the last collision between a U.S. Navy ship and a civilian vessel was more than a decade ago, in 2004. The unusual coincidence of collisions has led to speculation that something other than bad luck may be at play, and has focused attention on the threat of hacking and other kinds of electronic tampering to the U.S.'s modern, highly technology-dependent warships. Could the USS McCain or Fitzgerald have been hacked, and if so, how? To answer those questions, we sat down with researcher Ruben Santamarta of the firm IOActive, who is one of the world's recognized experts in the security of maritime software. I started by asking Ruben what went through his mind when he heard about the McCain accident and whether his first thought was of the potential for a software-based attack.
I mean, when I hear about these kind of incidents, when you read the details, maybe you can think that, okay, something weird is going on. Obviously, the hacking is always a possibility because you can basically control a vessel, you can control a car, you can control almost everything from a cyber perspective. But when you dig further into these issues, some things don't really match with a cyber incident. On one hand, we have the hacking is possibility. Technically, it's possible to perform this kind of attack that finally or eventually ends up in 2 vessels colliding. But if you take into account other factors, you also realize that it is also possible or likely that there is an explanation that it's not related to hacking. So far, we don't have enough details to provide a solid theory. But it's interesting that the U.S. Navy has decided to halt the fleet or to stop the operations of an entire fleet because obviously that's not very common. And definitely that means that something is going on, but we don't know yet whether this is more related to a series of catastrophic incidents or it's more related to a targeted attack.
Or it's just optics. It's just, you know, we need to show that we're doing something and that we're taking this seriously. So let's do this pause.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Tell us a little bit about some of the work that you've done on maritime systems. I know some of that's public research that you published. And I know that IOActive does a lot of consultative work that isn't public. So what are some of the patterns or problems that you found?
Almost 3 years ago, I presented a research on satellite systems that basically affected different sectors, including the maritime sector. I presented how it was possible to hack into some of the most widely deployed satellite communication devices that are on board cargo vessels, other mercant ships. And basically, this allows an attacker to perform different kind of actions, from modifying data that is coming from the outside world to the vessel, to jump from the IT networks, let's say, to the OT networks, to the industrial control systems. So I presented that research on 2014. And after that, I also presented some vulnerabilities in VDR, which is basically the black box for vessels, something like the black box for an aircraft.
Yeah, the VDR, the Voyage Data Recorder is what they call it.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. And it turns out that you can also hack into those devices. And it's important because in case of an accident, these devices record everything that can be used during an investigation to figure out what's really happened during the incident. So if someone is able to manipulate or destroy the information these devices record, then the authorities have a problem because they are missing important information.
You know, one of the charges back that you hear when you start talking about hacking these ships is that they are air-gapped, that they are not connected to the internet and therefore not vulnerable to internet-based, you know, remote software-based attacks. So two questions for you. First of all, is that true? Are these ships really air-gapped from the internet? And the second one would be, even if they are, does that preclude attacks that would affect the operation of the ship?
In theory, vessels, at least some part of the vessel, should be isolated from others. Basically, we can think of a vessel like a big city or a big factory. They have the industrial control systems network, and they have the IT networks for the crew because they need to talk to their families or watch TV, watch movies. They may need to access internet. The biggest vessels are like cities, basically. In theory, they should be isolated. But we have to think that the crew need to print some documentation or need to access internet to download email or to download other documentation, need to share files. So if we think of a vessel in this way, we can automatically think of the common attack vectors we see every day. We see USB, we see malicious emails, we see phishing, we see malware. So all those things may happen on board a cargo vessel as well.
One thing that you read about is that often these vessels are using applications that run on top of what seem to be consumer or business operating systems like Windows NT or Windows XP and quite old or out-of-date operating systems. Is that been your experience in the work that you've done in this sector too, that often we are talking about, you know, consumer-grade operating systems, whether those are, you know, Linux or Windows or something along those lines?
Sometimes we think that, okay, this kind of sophisticated environment, I'm sure they have a super exciting, ultra-secure operating system, but later on, it's most of the times they are using the same technology we use every day. So, like in any other industrial environment, we see these kind of operating systems, and we see this kind of outdated systems, outdated software. It's very common in the industrial world to see Windows XP or other ancient operating system versions of Windows. So, unfortunately, that's the reality. I don't think it's going to change in the short term.
In some of the investigations that have been done into these incidents, they talk about a loss of situational awareness. And I'm wondering, is there a risk here that as crew members become more reliant on technology to tell them, you know, where their ship is in space and time, and and where other ships are. Is there a danger that seamen are just doing what all of us do in our daily lives, just counting on the technology, relying on the technology to be accurate, and losing the type of situational awareness that 50 years ago or 60 years ago you had to have just because there was no technology really to rely on?
Yeah, well, right. That's a good question. But I mean, the kind of technology we are using right now, it's here to stay. We can't think of a world different from the current one. We can't go back to use technology or the lack of technology we had 50 years ago. But it's important to secure the technology that we have right now and the technology that we'll have in 10 years now. That's the important thing. Obviously, from the operational perspective, I think that right now crews rely on this technology to properly operate a vessel. Probably the most veteran people know how to handle these situations without completely relying on technology, but at some time that will disappear, and we have to realize that we'll be relying purely on technology to handle or to operate safety critical systems. So we don't have to fight against it. We have to try to secure the technology instead of fighting it. But definitely it's interesting because we are adding technology and layers of technology to everything, to our devices, the devices that we have at home, but also the devices that are used to transport stuff around the world or transport people around the world. So it's important to secure everything, not only the devices that we have at home, that maybe they are spying on us, but it's important to secure the vessels or the aircraft, because a problem with the security of those systems has a significant impact against the safety of people.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, sure.
Have you ever let your GPS, like Waze or Google Maps, drive you someplace that was the wrong destination?
Yeah, actually, yes. Actually, it happened after Black Hat, which was very, very funny. I was trying to go to Yosemite, and I don't want to say where I ended up. So, but well, it was funny. It was funny.
Let me ask you this: how far off your course were you?
Way far away. Okay.
It wasn't a 3-minute correction.
No. Absolutely not.
If you were advising, you know, the U.S. Navy or other navies about the threats to maritime, you know, security, both of their navies, Coast Guard, and even their, you know, their commercial fleets, how would you prioritize the risk?
Well, on top of the threats, I assume that we should say all those radio threats, GPS or any other radio system that maybe is spoofed or maybe hacked from remote without any physical access to the controlled environment. If you are receiving an attack from 50 kilometers away, well, that's a problem. So that's the priority. Obviously, satellite communication systems are also very important attack vector. And after those attack vectors, we should take into account the supply chain. You should take into account what kind of devices are entering into your vessel, what kind of people or what kind of information is going through your physical environment. Obviously, the regular attack vectors we see every day, we can't forget. That's also an important attack vector for these kind of systems. So let's not forget the basics and stick to the common sense. We are talking about a scenario where highly sophisticated actors are involved, capabilities that are not currently publicly available, we can say. So it's a different war. I mean, we have the commercial shipping companies, and we have the warships. And these warships, they have on board electronic warfare equipment. They should be able to detect these. So a different scenario. Like, when I read about these incidents, okay, I thought it's possible to that maybe hacking is involved, but we should think of other scenarios like human failure or something like that before getting involved into hacking theories. But, well, let's see. I mean, time will tell.
Do you feel like they do have the ability to both detect those attacks when they're happening and forensically after the fact if they need to?
We have to take into account that on board warships, there are different teams that are taking control of different part of the vessels, and they are continuously monitoring positions. They are continuously monitoring different systems. It's different from a cargo vessel. In a cargo vessel, not every system is continuously monitored. So there are significant differences between commercial shipping companies and the military. So I can't say they should detect all these kind of attacks, but they should be able to know that something weird is going on, and they also have different sources of inputs. I mean, they are not relying only on just one input. For example, if they are facing a GPS spoofing attack, they have other ways to avoid the collision against a mercant, for example, or a cargo vessel. So it may happen, but it sounds a little bit weird for me. That was what really happened. For example, we say that maybe a malware is taking control of the steering, any other navigation control at a specific moment. Okay, that possible, and I would be okay with that theory. But in this case, I don't know if that's the most or the easiest theory to explain the accident. But, well, let's see. A couple of months, we'll get access to more details. Maybe we can try to figure out what was really going on. But right now, I think it's just speculation.
Ruben Santamarta, thank you so much for coming in and talking to the Security Ledger podcast.
Okay, thank you very much.
Ruben Santamarta is a principal security consultant at the firm IOActive. He joined us to talk about the recent spate of U.S. Navy collisions and the state of maritime cybersecurity. Next up, the U.S. Congress is taking its first swing at regulating the security of the fast-growing Internet of Things with the Internet of Things Cybersecurity Improvement Act, which was introduced in early August. The act mandates security features for connected devices purchased by the U.S. government. So how big an impact might it have on the private sector and consumers? To answer that, we invited Alan Brill, a senior managing director of Kroll Cybersecurity, into the Security Ledger studios. I started off by asking Alan to tell us a little bit more about the Cybersecurity Improvement Act and what it would do.
So what this bill says is that federal agencies are going to be required under the bill to take an inventory of the IoT devices that they already have, which is a great idea because at least you know what risk you already have bought into. And it also requires that those manufacturing devices that are IoT for purchase by the federal government have to follow certain rules about the device using standard protocols, being updatable, not having hard-coded passwords, but also recognizing that there may be instances in which other controls could compensate for those and providing a mechanism by which a federal agency can request a waiver of the specific rules in the proposed legislation to be able to acquire and use certain IoT devices. All in all, it's a recognition of a reality that we at Kroll have been talking to our clients about for a long time, that these are risk factors, that whether you as an organization bought them or individuals brought them in and attached them to your network, once these devices are in there, whatever advantage they provide is great. but whatever risk they provide, you suddenly own. So I think that this legislation codifies in the federal government context what I would really think of as being best practice for both the public and the private sector.
And Alan Brill, when we're talking about Internet of Things devices that, let's say, Kroll's customers may have in their environments, what types of things are we talking about? Are these the same types of connected devices that we may have in our homes, you know, the Wemo switches and the Nest thermostats and those types of things, or different types of devices?
Well, it's certainly everything that you might have in your home. And it's everything that a government agency, depending on what it does, might be involved with. So, for example, if you were doing environmental monitoring, if you were doing monitoring of conditions in at mines or in petroleum facilities or any place, you might have sensors which reported via the Internet and would be part of an Internet of Things. Organizations may have devices that respond to voice and may have problems that could lead them to be listening posts for people that you don't want to have listening in. So I think the thing to remember is that because these devices are expanding at an ever-increasing rate, whatever list of IoT devices I could give you would probably be obsolete before your next podcast.
This is a bill that is really focused on government acquisition of Internet of Things technology, and it sets parameters or requirements around government purchase of these devices, not private sector and not consumer. Does that limit the impact of the bill, or is leading by example in the federal space going to be enough to tip the market, as it were?
I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding is that there are limitations on what can be regulated in the private sector for these devices that may be more complicated from a legislative or regulatory perspective than setting standards for the federal government. Having said that, I think when you look at the bill, you see that important parts of it are actually directed toward organizations that build these devices for sale to the government. And I think the intent there is that if they start building more secure devices because that's what it takes to sell to the federal government, that those improvements in security would also likely exist for devices that might be bought by an individual or a corporation. So I think it's a little more than, you know, leading by suggestion or leading by example, but it's an attempt to move the actions of the developers and vendors of these devices to, in general, provide a more secure device environment.
How much awareness is there around some of the security issues that this bill addresses? For example, you know, the ability of device makers to actively manage and update their devices after they've been purchased and deployed, or, you know, security of, you know, passwords that might be used to access a device and whether they allow, you know, weak security or default security passwords. Are these issues that your clients are paying attention to, or is this all terra nova for them?
Well, I think to some extent, because of the speed at which the IoT grows and because it's just an open market that anybody can build devices for, largely without any standardized security requirements. But I think you have to look at this marketplace as one that is affecting everybody. So what we are, that information security professionals are recognizing that this represents a risk factor. And they also recognize that they need to get a handle on it, which probably starts with an inventory of devices that are on their network, not just by asking people but by actually examining the network and seeing what's attached and having the ability through network security to notice when a new device is attached to their network so that they can evaluate it and determine whether or not it's perhaps a device that an employee is bringing in from home and is connecting to the network, which might really become a security hazard, not just for that individual, but for the network as a whole. And then in terms of acquisition, I think there is also a recognition growing rather quickly in the information security community that you have to get involved. You have to try to set some rules, try to set some standards, and know what's being evaluated for purchase so that you can at least tell those who have to make the decisions about the security risks that come with them and remind them that very few devices come without some security risk. It's a matter of evaluating that risk, the value of that risk, and which, if any, compensating security controls might enable you to use a device even with a known risk without materially degrading the security of your network.
One of the criticisms I've read of this bill, just from within the sort of legal and policy community, is that it doesn't say much about the security of data that might be stored in the cloud. In other words, many of these devices collect data, send it off to cloud-based management servers and storage, and then obviously use it. And this bill is mostly silent about that piece of the Internet of Things, you know, ecosystem. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that to some extent, that represents a conflation of kind of apples and oranges, because one of the problems we face is the IoT, and it requires attention. It requires action both now to understand what's already out there and proactively to try to improve the security of devices that the federal government and of course, corporations and individuals acquire over time. The issue of data storage in the cloud, how it's stored, where it's stored, legal implications of devices, device storage that ends up in another country or in the EU subject to their rules is, I think, a different subject. It is one that deserves security attention. It is one that both government, which is moving quickly toward the use of cloud-based technology, and the private sector have to look at. But I think that this bill does a great service by focusing on IoT and setting some both immediate actions and forward-looking actions to protect that aspect of information security.
This is a bipartisan bill, which is a rarity these days in Washington, D.C. And we've seen the inability in the last decade, for example, to get bipartisan support for things like data privacy or data protection law at the federal level. You know, we haven't been able to get that done. Why do you think that there's agreement in this area of Internet of Things security where there's been more division in other areas related to information security policy and lawmaking?
I think that the caucus that put this bill together, the study group, recognized that there's no real question that IoT devices bring with them risks, whether it is demonstrations that people have seen of a hacker being able to take over a connected automobile or a hacker able to access a device and steal data. It's a real issue, and it's an issue that has to be looked at because acquisition of these items has already begun. So while I suspect there is a broader potential range of views on things like privacy and how that should be implemented, if you look at what this bill says and requires, it's pretty straightforward, and I think should be rather non-controversial. So there is an easier lift for a bill like this, which isn't likely to engender a lot of disagreement. It represents a great start toward getting better control over all of the federal networks and to provide direction to the public and private sectors.
If you were emperor, Alan, and could wave your hand and make changes to this bill, what would you change, either add, subtract, modify?
I think at this point, given the bipartisan nature of the bill and the fact that its basic suggestions with regard to the Internet of Things make sense for both, I think, the public and private sectors, I would say let this bill go forth and go through the legislative process and hopefully be something that both houses would agree on as being nonpartisan and really important for our nation's security, and send it to the president, who I hope would agree with that assessment and sign it.
One of the really tricky problems for companies, and I'm sure your customers, is the software and hardware supply chain, and Internet of Things really complicates that. Understanding the provenance of the devices that you're bringing into your organization, where they were manufactured, who contributed to the device, both software and hardware. Do you think this bill will help shore up that software supply chain, or is that just another big hairy problem that companies are going to have to wrestle with more or less on their own?
Well, clearly supply chain is, you know, has issues far beyond anything to do with the Internet of Things in terms of the security of things, whether they're hardware or software, that are acquired. But I think that going back to what we discussed earlier, the portions of this bill that essentially provide a guidance checklist to the manufacturers of these devices in regard to what constitutes reasonable IoT security for a device represents something that a company can adopt or adapt to give it a way of looking at what's coming through the supply chain and specifying what represents the kind of device that you'd be willing to attach to your network and that you wouldn't be willing to attach to your network, and what controls should be a part of the corporation's IoT security plan and implementation of that plan. It's vital for both government agencies, and not just at the federal level, but at the state and municipal level, to recognize that this is not a future problem. You can't simply say, well, we'll create some guidelines, some standards for acquisition, because the devices are already there. And it can be anything from an appliance in a police station or a firehouse to devices that are used by other agencies in federal, state, and local government. So I think if you asked whether I thought, for example, that doing these inventories at any level in both the public and private sector should wait for something like this to become law, no, I think that starting with an inventory of what's attached to your system and rules about whether things can just be attached to your system without authorization is a very, very much right now problem that I would urge both public and private sector organizations to begin addressing right now.
Alan Brill, Senior Managing Director in the Cybersecurity and Investigations Program at Kroll, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to the Security Ledger podcast. We loved having you.
Thanks very much. Let me know if I can help again.
Alan Brill is a managing director of Kroll Cybersecurity. He joined us to talk about the Internet of Things Cybersecurity Improvement Act, which was introduced earlier this month. And finally, a new survey by the firm Veracode found that 70% of information technology professionals feel that their security education is not adequate for their current positions. With us in the Security Ledger studio to talk about the survey is Maria Lachlan. She's the Vice President of Engineering at Veracode, which is a business unit of CA. Maria, welcome to the Security Ledger podcast.
Thank you, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. So tell us, Maria, just a little bit about the survey that Veracode did of 400 development professionals. What were you guys trying to find out?
We wanted to understand, well, where are we with the understanding of security in IT and software engineering organizations? We are seeing that DevSecOps is really bringing visibility to security in the development lifecycle. So we're very, very excited about that. So we want DevSecOps to be successful. And so a lot of what we're trying to understand in this survey is, where is the DevOps expertise? What's the level? Where is the security expertise? And if we understand where we're at and the causes for what brings us to where we are, we can be a loud voice to the academic institutions, to organizations such as ourselves, in how to bring it to the right place.
So explain for our listeners just briefly, in case they don't know, what is DevOps?
I look at DevOps as agile all the way from the beginning to the ongoing deployment and maintenance of software. So Agile brought together cross-functional teams. At that point in time, the focus was on development, user experience, software engineers and test and quality. And Agile looked at forming a full-featured, full-powered, autonomous and empowered Scrum team to build software. DevOps stretches the boundaries. So with DevOps, we're looking all the way from design, requirements gathering, to deployment, maintenance, monitoring, and the feedback loop from customers and usage of the product back into the development process. So to make DevOps successful, automation is a key component. DevOps typically works well when there are small increments of change that are happening very quickly. And to make that happen with high quality and predictability, we want a lot of automation. DevSecOps is really a term. It's just a term, but it's recognizing that security has to be a key and integrated part of the DevOps process. And our belief at Veracode is that the way to do that most effectively is to make security part of the everyday dialogue and to build security into that CD pipeline, CI/CD pipeline.
Who are the respondents for this survey? Are these computer science majors or a mix of majors? What are we talking about?
A mix of majors, Paul. There were about 400 respondents, and this is topical. The survey was compiled in May and June of this year. So focusing on developers and operations experts, there were a few security, there were a few QA professionals in there, and the majority had 5+ years of experience. When polled as to their primary degree, it was heavily computer science, about 60%. But there was a good number that had taken other IT classes with a smattering of liberal arts and other education. Mostly was at the primary degree level, bachelor's level. There was about 25% had a master's and then a few doctorate and associate levels. And it was a global survey with a lot of participants from North America, but also many from Europe and Asia.
Let's talk about computer science education at the university level. What does it look like today and how different is it from, you know, the type of computer science education you would have gotten 10 or 15 years ago?
So within the survey, Veracode talked with a few college professors to get a sense of, well, what did they say about colleges and their offerings around security today? So what we learned was that 25% of colleges offer a dedicated computer security program, and that's great. So folks who want to specialize in computer science, in security within computer science, have an avenue because 25% of the computer science colleges do offer that. What I think we need is to balance that emphasis on deep security expertise with broad, raising the bar for broad security awareness, because organizations such as Veracode need IT experts that are expert in their field and have some security knowledge. So there are ACM guidelines that are active today for computer science. And the guideline is that 3 to 9 lecture hours in a computer science degree should be allocated to security. So 3 to 9 hours is really not that much in a 4-year college degree. I would like to see that increased. I'd like to see that rather than having 1 hour on the very deep topic of cryptography, a computer science graduate has a much deeper understanding.
Yeah. 3 to 9 hours, that's like a good dorm party, pretty much, you know.
It is. And my concern is that 3 to 9 hours is probably distributed across the 4-year degree. So you just get a little bit of network security and then you forget about it. And you just get a little bit about defensive programming and then you forget about it.
Right.
And what I think is going to change the baseline is that security can be integrated into the talk track of everything that you're learning. Bring it into the algorithm class, bring it into the exploration of networks and mobile devices and systems and how they function, so that it's not allocated solely to those, you know, checkbox hours around computer security, but that it's part of the integrated way that people learn when they're learning computer science.
What types of courses or skills might need to be taught or would be appropriate to be taught at the undergraduate or graduate level? I mean, are we talking about teaching folks how to hack into applications or just to write more defensible code?
I think both of those are a great starting point. Firstly, writing defensible code. I think everybody that learns a language should understand what are the vulnerabilities that may be associated with that language, because programming languages are different. And it would be great that as engineers, software developers are coming through the college, they get an understanding that every language has its idiosyncrasies and they need to understand how and where to code defensively. As an example, there's many classes on algorithms and operating systems. For algorithms in particular, a lot of the programming assignments are just about the algorithm and pay no attention whatsoever to the data protection on the way in and on the way out of that algorithm. And it would be nice if that notion of coding defensively was incorporated there, so that people are thinking of the big picture when they go into the workforce. They're thinking that way, and they will apply the security skills where they make sense. You also talked about, Paul, about understanding the point of view of the attacker. So in addition to learning about programming defensively, I think that's such a healthy thing to do. It gives a different perspective to think about how somebody's going to attack your code. It's actually very fun, and I think it can make for great class or activities in terms of capture the flag or other activities that programmers might want to engage in. I think thinking of from that perspective tends to be unusual in both the college world as well as the enterprise world. And I think it will be very healthy for us to have more of an emphasis on that.
Is there something about the shift within the business world, the software development world, to the DevOps model that exacerbates this lack of information security skills? Or is it just a continuation of the same, you know, supply and demand problem that we've had for a long time?
I see the shift to DevOps as very positive. It does exacerbate the concern, but I think it's a healthy change. I think it's really highlighting an issue that had been more latent, but very much there in the past. So the reason that it highlights the problem is that now developers are becoming aware that they really are responsible for the software after it's deployed, during deployment, after deployment. And so now I'll speak as a person in this role, as a development leader, I'm feeling accountable for that. And so I'm raising the flag and I'm making sure that my team has access to all of the training that they need, that there's very solid and structured checkpoints for security all the way from design through code review, through pair programming to the DevOps pipelines, etc. Veracode is, as you know, sell services around application security, static analysis, dynamic analysis, e-learning. What we're seeing is a very significant shift in who the buyer is. We've always sold to compliance organizations, the security hub of large enterprises as well as developers, and we continue to sell across that spectrum. But what we're seeing is that the pull, the first reach out, the decision makers in many, many more of the sales that we make is now from development organizations. So I think that there's a shift and it's very healthy because it's recognizing and having a new set of teams that are engineering teams empowered and motivated to really take this on.
You know, in the United States, unlike in other countries, there is a little bit of a divide, well, more than a little bit of a divide between the business community and the private sector and what is taught in the academy. But here we're really talking about a need that the private sector has, how do we push that down and influence or change the way that this very important skill is being taught in the academy?
I think change will come through partnership. There certainly has to be leaders within the academic community that are taking this on. I have the pleasure of knowing Min Chow at Tufts University in Boston. And
yes,
he's an example of a professor that's really taking this and bringing security into the classroom. So that notion of collaboration, Min is also very much attached to some of the Boston area companies. And so making sure that there's dialogue across industry and academia, and making sure that there are champions within the academic institutions to bring this. I think that we've all had the teacher that made us excited about a particular topic because they themselves were excited about that. For myself, I can say that was geography, which really wasn't my sweet spot, but I had one teacher that I will always remember that made this be important to me. So I think if we can get that collaboration and get champions within the computer science world, within the computer science curriculum and the larger IT organizations that really want to bring this in, and their energy and drive will be supported by industry, that can make all the difference. The other thing I think we need to make sure to do is get students interested in the topic. It's not just about the book learning that's going to happen. It's about that lifelong interest in security, understanding the mind of the attacker, understanding that programming languages have different idiosyncrasies. So when you pick up a new one all through your career, you should be thinking about how is security going to play out in the way that you're currently programming. And so getting that interest going is part of what I think academia can really instill.
One of the things your survey revealed was that not only are these professionals not getting the security training in college, but often they are also not getting it in their workplace. So they're not getting, they might be learning on the job, but they're not getting structured training once they're on the job. Their employers more often than not are not paying for it. And is that something that needs to change?
It is something that needs to change. 70% of the respondents of the survey said that their security education was not adequate. And that implies that they need to learn security on the job. However, we got also difficult feedback that they feel that their organizations are not fully supporting their need to learn security on the job. Vericode has thought long and hard about this. How do we take the developers that we have at Vericode and make them security aware, security proficient? Also, for the customers that we serve, how do we help them after understanding vulnerabilities that may be present in their code or in the third-party code that they're embedding? How do we make them be able to be responsive? I think there are a lot of different approaches we can take in industry. Some of it is going to be classroom learning. Some of it is going to be e-learning. Some of it is going to be making sure that our engineers are getting out from the office, going to conferences. Just about every conference these days, it doesn't have to be a security conference, any development conference, or let's say a DevOps conference, an AWS conference, there are tracks around security. So I think we really need to encourage our teams to engage in that broader community and take opportunity in all of those forums to learn about security.
Maria Lachlan, VP of Engineering at Vericode, thanks so much for coming and speaking with us at the Security Ledger podcast. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Paul. I enjoyed talking with you.
We were speaking with Maria Lachlan. She's the Vice President of Engineering at the firm Vericode, a division of CA.